All right, thank you very much. And I really am continuing, so it's going to start with section four. So if you've kept track, I think we're on section four. I wanted to say one last thing about series, and this is going to be about next to leading log type stuff, so more on series. And this isn't actually something that I'm directly involved in, but I thought it fit with the story, and it's some fairly recent work that is probably not well known to this crowd, so I thought I would just give you a very brief overview of it, and you can look up the details yourself if you're interested. So this is due to Olaf Krüger and Dirk Kreimer. And if you want to look it up on the archive, I should have given archives numbers yesterday, but anyway, you can look it all up. But here's this. And I think this fits in very naturally with the story I was telling before, because it's about the next to leading log story. So let me just be precise about what I mean about that. So yesterday we talked about leading logs. Briefly anyway. Okay, and what do I mean about that? I mean, well, we had the situation, we had they occurred, so which occurred in the case where my Feynman rules on my tree, and I was just using a tree to represent an insertion structure, if it was just some constant, depending on the tree, times L to the size of the tree, then when you put that in, you got just the part that I was calling the leading log. But more generally, well, what do you have if you're still, we're still thinking single scale here, so you still want to think of this as two-point functions, but okay, fine. So suppose you want to play at least the two-point function game more generally. Then your Feynman rules, I'll just think of them again for trees for now. After you play the whole game, you're going to get some polynomial. So let's say I from 1 up to the size of the tree, some coefficients, ci, depending on the tree, L to the I, something like that. And so when you make your Green's function, which was the result of applying phi to this sum over all the trees in whatever your class of trees was, alpha to the size of tree, then you're going to have a sum over, well, the trees, but then also over the i's, c, I, tree, L to the I, alpha to the size of the tree. Okay, and then now just to be precise, so if I take the part, or if I, what's the best way to say this? Okay, well, the part with, you know, L and alpha to the same power for any power. So the part with L and alpha to the same power is the leading log part. And then so on. And the next to leading log, that's some L to the J, alpha to the J over all J's, and then whatever your coefficient is. And if you have instead L to the J minus 1, alpha to the J, you know, and your stuff, this is just stuff, then that's your next to leading log. Next to leading log. And then the next one is called the next to leading log, and it goes on like that. And in general, you get, you know, any next to some power. I already had a JI leading log. That really is the language they use. I promise you, it's actually called that. All right? Just to be clear what we're talking about.
Okay, well, what did Krieger and Kreimer do? They said that,
well, what's really going on here? Let's
try to think of the general shape. Of course, different specific theories, different particular choices of Feynman rules, you know, they make a real difference. They're going to change how you evaluate each graph and, you know, really make a big difference.
But there's something common to the general shape. And in particular, they were thinking, when the new periods show up, when do I need to care about new periods, and how do they get put together into the different, into this gradation by the powers of L? And so, for example, for the leading log part, you only ever need to think about putting together the sort of highest, or the one loop, the simplest primitive, because and just shuffling it together. You never have to worry about the lower order terms that it contributes either, because those will show up in the later leading log terms. So what do they do? I'm just going to give a really brief sketch of this before we go on to something else. So just let me say Krieger and Kreimer, they said, so they use shuffles and Lie brackets to characterize the terms that show up, all right? So you want to think of shuffles just giving sort of the dominant part, the leading part, when you insert a graph into itself. And the brackets are giving the next order down of a given insertion. So I would say, for example, the leading log is pure shuffle. And it's pure shuffle of the sort of first piece. Okay, well, great, so that's fine. But really what was, I think, interesting is doing this, they were able to give a differential equation that satisfied, well, in principle, they can write down a differential equation for any term in the next to next to next to leading log expansion. But it's only explicit if you fix a particular choice. So there's not a closed form, but there's an in-principle algorithmic technique to find a differential equation for any piece of that log expansion. So they found an algorithm to give differential equations for the terms of the log expansion. As in why is the high power of L the leading term and everything else the lower? Like, why am I thinking of it that way?
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm thinking of it that way. I mean, maybe we're just being practical and saying the highest powers of L are the ones we can deal with easiest. I'm not sure. They certainly are the ones you can deal with easiest. But yeah, it's the log of the external momentum. So yeah, if you really want to think of it as a sensible expansion parameter, you probably want to keep that log small. So the highest power of L for any given diagram, that's the leading log. Right, because the powers of L that it can contribute are anywhere from 1 up to its size, where its size as measured by the power of the coupling constant. And so the leading term is the largest one, which is the one where the power matches the power of the coupling constant.
Okay,
fine. Anyway, I guess that makes sense. Large energy, right? Okay, now I'm not, yes. So let me just give you two examples of this. And then if you care, you can go look up how it goes. So for example, let me just give you the differential equation for the leading log term in, again, that Yukawa case that we were talking about yesterday. Leading log
And so like I said, that's pure shuffle. In the Yukawa case. Okay, well, this is meant to be the easiest part, so it should satisfy an easy differential equation, and it does. It satisfies the following differential equation. Here's my g. How do I want to think about that? Well, there's really only one variable. So let's just write g prime is equal to 1 plus the sum of the gk, k greater than or equal to 1, g power k. Okay, but that's just, I'm just saying 1 over 1 minus g there. And so that's a differential equation that you can solve.
Question?
Yes.
Is this differential equation coming from the
Bessel function? Where does it come from? Sort of. The best way to think of it is it comes from this algorithm where you decompose the different terms using shuffles and Lie brackets. I think that's the best way to say it. Well, at the moment, it doesn't matter because we're doing the leading log term, right? Because the alpha and the L come together in this case.
But it's not coming from Bessel.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's not the only ingredient, I maybe is more the better way to say it. Okay? Yes?
Is this the RG equation?
I mean, all these things come in as ingredients, but the ingredient that made them, at least in my view, the ingredient that made it possible to use what are, you know, standard physics things and get what are, I think, somewhat new results, was this algorithm to decompose it, which let you pull out the different terms. Because, of course, we have lots of differential equations relating all these things together, but not always in a way where you can extract. You know, you can't just say, I would like to extract the next to, you know, 5 leading log part, right? That's not something that's all that easy to pull out. And so to me, what the key of this was is this algorithm to canonically decompose the different levels in terms of shuffles and Lie brackets. And then once you have that decomposition, then you really are just using standard things that you already know in physics, and you can pull out these different differential equations. All right, I'm sorry, that wasn't the greatest answer in the world, but hopefully it helped a little. All right, I'm going to just write down what you get if you solve this. So you just get a square root, essentially, right? As you can see, it's not a hard thing to solve. And of course, this is the leading log, so alpha and L go together. And as your last little tantalizing detail, well, what if you do all the work, what does the next to leading log look like? Then you've got terms coming from, so this comes from just shuffling the sort of first primitive. So you can think of this as just a shuffle power of some A1. Shuffled however many times, arbitrarily many times. And then the next term is going to come, you can shuffle many copies of A1 with A2. So that's saying you can have the simplest primitive, but you can also have the one more complicated primitive. So you have a two-loop primitive along with one-loop primitive. And you can get the brackets. And the brackets are where this algorithm is non-trivial, because you don't have a unique way in principle, but you make a choice. And the key is to choose to make consistent choices, to have an algorithm that tells you how to make consistent choices, to always break it down. So you essentially get 3 different terms, and all together, so e.g., the next to leading log gives the following. And here's where you start to see some periods coming up. So this is a period. And you get a 1 over square root of 1 minus 2u. So 1 minus 2u is sort of the key variable, the correct form of the variable, times, oh, I shouldn't put it here. There's not enough room. Let's just put it under here. Times a log of the same thing.
plus a C2. All right, and so the C1 and the C2, these are the two primitives which show up at this order. Sorry, two new periods, I mean. And then the rest of it is, you know, some fairly well-controlled functions of alpha L. And then, of course, since this is the next deleting log, we have to have one extra power of alpha, and it's just been put in here explicitly. So I just wanted to briefly say that. You can look up the details if you're interested. Just as, because what were we talking about yesterday? We were talking about how to play combinatorial games with these series expansions and try to pull things out that are interesting physically, or at least hope to. And we talked about just doing pure leading log, which was just weighting generating functions. And I showed you the core diagram expansion, which I think is pretty cool, but as some people were commenting afterwards, it's kind of out of nowhere. And then here's another approach that's been recently developed that uses some nice algebraic structure to pull out some, you know, I mean, they're just logs and square roots and rational functions and pretty explicit things out of some simple differential equations. And
is the differential equation for the next leading log
similar to the first order equation? Yeah, so it gets much more complicated. Basically, yeah, it's a first order equation, but then, so you'll have your derivative of g, and it's equal, instead of equal to something straightforward, it's equal to something a lot more complicated that has some coefficients that come from, well, they're essentially combinatorial coefficients. They're coming from how many ways you can build these different shuffle terms and things like that. And that's what prevents there from being an actual closed form, because there's not a characterization of those things. So you can write down, if you set up some notation for those, you can actually write down what the general differential equation would be. But you can't really say anything about it, because you've got these combinatorial coefficients that you don't actually know very much about. And then if you want any particular case, well, you work it out. You say, how many ways are there to make this shuffle out of these different pieces, and go from there. All right? OK. That's the last thing I wanted to say about series expansions. And now I would like to talk a bit about the periods. So we saw both in this and in the core diagram expansion, where we had those Fs, that somewhere the analytic information has to come in, right? I've been so far telling you about how you put it all together, and I think there's a lot of interesting things to say about how you put it together. But you also, you need the numbers, right? So let's call this 5. So what about those periods? Well, in general, of course, that's really hard, as some of you know who've probably computed Feynman diagrams. And so I want to restrict to the same simplest case, which I suspect is what Matilda talked about on Wednesday, I hope I'm right, about doing these massless scalar phi 4 graphs and looking at sort of a first period that you get out of them using the Kirchhoff polynomial. And obviously, that's not the whole story of periods, but it's a good place to start, and there's already lots of interesting things you can say there, as you already know. So in general, it's very hard. And so what do we want to do? So let's take the case. And what are we looking at? Well, OK, we're looking at 5-4 graphs. And I just want to think about 4-point graphs. OK, so just 4-point graphs in 5-4 theory. There you go. And well, I would have a subdivergence here if I have a subgraph whose external structure is either four legs or 2. So I don't want that. So and I want no subdivergences. So what does that mean? So that means no case where inside the graph I can, you know, cut four edges and have a piece come off. All right, so that I don't want that to happen.
I need to know that.
And as a first observation, let me just say that there's actually a nice way to say that. There's a nice graph theoretic language for that. And so I need one thing before I can do that. So let's just say, given a four-point graph, if I add one new vertex and connect it to all the external edges, we'll call that the completion of the graph. And so this completion is a four-regular graph. All right. And now there's a nice language for that. So what this is saying is I would like a four-regular graph that's internally six-edge connected. So then a graph of this sort is subdivergent, has no subdivergences, is primitive, if its completion is internally six edge connected. Okay, I'm just telling you that in case you ever want to talk to a graph theorist. What does this mean? So six edge connected would normally mean that in order to disconnect the graph, you would have to cut at least six edges. All right? It's sort of the opposite of the 1PI, right? The graph theorists tell you how many you have to cut to actually disconnect it, as opposed to how many you can cut before you disconnect it. Okay, but of course, a four regular graph can never actually be six edge connected, because I could always just cut off a vertex. And that's what the internally is saying. Internally means when I do this, on both sides, I have to get more than just a vertex. All right, so this means that. Do you want me to write that down? No, OK, fine. It means that. It's called internally six edge connected. You can look it up if you want to talk to graph theorists. If I'm going to do this, yeah, well, I can. There's ways to cut six. Sorry, did I say, I might have said it wrong. Sorry, it's not that every six edge cut disconnects it. That's definitely not going to be true. The point is, it's impossible to disconnect it with a less than six edge cut. All right? And if it's exactly six edge connected, then there should be a six edge cut that'll disconnect it. But let's not even worry about that. Let's just say that anything smaller than this cannot disconnect the graph. That's why you're sort of off by one compared to the physicist's way of saying these things. Sorry, I may not have said that the first time, but that's what I meant. Sorry about that. All right? Everyone cool with that? All right. Well, what is this period that I hope you heard about on Wednesday? So define, and I know you saw the Kirchhoff polynomial because I saw it this morning. Here's the Kirchhoff polynomial of the graph, and I'm going to sum over the spanning trees. T, big T, of the graph, and then I'm going to take the product of the edges that are not in the tree, and then the variable for that edge. So make a monomial of the edges that you have to cut to get yourself a spanning tree, and then the period is, well, and I'm just going to take the first part of it. So I'm not even going to give myself a numerator. I'm just going to say, well, morally, I would like to say it's 1 over psi squared. But of course, I got to tell you what you're supposed to integrate. So you should integrate all these guys from 0 to infinity. And then if you do that, you're going to need to put a projective volume form up here. Or you could just set one of the variables equal to 1 and then integrate all the rest, whatever you like best.
All right, here, I'll just put omega, and I'll assume that you already heard about that. Is that cool? Did you hear about that on Wednesday? Seem familiar? I hope so. Okay. Oh, okay. I didn't say how many edges the graph had. I don't know, n. Okay? Is that okay? You like to integrate over that? Does that make you happy? There's a variable for each edge. And then down here, I've numbered them just so that I can put them together in some sensible order. Yeah, you can think of it as a residue from the full Feynman integral, but it's also a perfectly good period in the sense that everything in sight is algebraic. And as written, it does actually converge as long as there are no subdivergences. You could check that. I mean, there's nothing difficult about it because. Notation for the contour. It's not really a contour. I mean, it's like just a whole region, right? Like, I'm just thinking set all the variables. Like, I'm just taking like a positive, the whole positive first, you know, n thing. So if you don't like that, the simple way to do this is just integrate them one at a time from zero to infinity. But then the very last one, don't actually integrate it, just set it to one. All right? That's just choosing, like this is writing it projectively, and then you're choosing an affine piece by setting one of them to one. That's the easy way to do it. If I was actually going to, like, I'm not the integral expert. You know, you actually start integrating them one at a time and see what happens. Does that make you that good? Any other comments or questions?
What is the denominator? Is that psi squared?
Psi squared, yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes. Okay. So this is something interesting, and you can study it with algebraic geometry if you're the kind of person who likes to study it with algebraic geometry. But as you've probably learned by now, I like to study things by combinatorics. So if I'm going to try to study that thing by combinatorics, that doesn't look like combinatorics at all, right? But there's a graph at least. So that's a good sign. There's a graph. And in fact, there are a number of nice graph operations which are known to preserve this period. And so that's what I want to think about next. Okay, so what are they? The first one is the planar dual. I should give that thing a name so that I can talk about it. That sounds like a good idea. Shall we call it, let's see, if there's a graph G, this will be psi G, and I'll call this, how about P sub G for a period. Is that all right? So what do I mean by planar dual? So if G is one of these 4.54 graphs and it happens to be planar, and G star is its planar dual, then P of G is P of G star. Does everyone know what the planar dual is, or would you like a picture? Who would like a picture of what planar dual is? Okay, I need to find a color, and then you can have your picture. There must be a color somewhere. Not here. This one has one? Lots of them, in fact. A choice of red or green. Okay. Well, let's draw a graph. So here's a graph. It's even a four-point graph in 5-4. Yay! For the purpose of the planar dual, though, I'm going to ignore the external legs. It's just a graph. And it has a planar embedding. It's a planar graph. And then to make the planar dual, what I do is I put a new vertex for the new graph in each face, including the external face of my planar embedding. And then I connect these vertices by edges if the two faces were connected by an edge. Now, in this case, I actually get an isomorphic graph, but that's just a special coincidence about this graph. In general, you can get something quite different. If your graph is 3 connected, then this is actually unique. If your graph is not 3 connected, then it's not quite unique because you have a little bit of choice in your planar embedding. If you pull it apart at a two-vertex join, you can put it back together the other way up. And that gives a, in general, non-isomorphic graph. But the planar dual can't see that difference. It depends on the choice of planar embedding. So, yeah. But that doesn't matter for the sort of things we're going to do anyway, because the period's invariant under that transformation as well. Okay, is that good? Happy with planar dual? All right. If your graph is not planar, then you have to move into the land of matroids if you want to do something analogous. And in fact, this whole story is going to work there, or a lot of this story is going to work in that land as well. But I'm not telling that story today. So you don't have to worry about matroids. You can forget you ever heard them. All right. So planar dual preserves the period. And why is that? Well, that's really just the Fourier transform yet again, if you think about that on the original integral. And I think this is something that was known classically, but it was certainly known to David Broadhurst and may well be known to pretty much many people who would work in this kind of Feynman integral. What else can you do? Well, I told you about this completion. So if you complete and then decomplete. Well, I'm probably at a different vertex, right? Otherwise, it's pretty trivial. So basically, if G1 and G2 have isomorphic completion, then they have the same period. All right. That was certainly also known to David Broadhurst. I don't, again, know who thought of it first. K4. They're actually surprisingly hard to compute. But K4, you could actually just sit down with your favorite computer algebra system, and you could just say, okay, let's integrate the first variable, simplify. Let's integrate the second variable, simplify. Integrate the third variable. The last time I tried it in Maple could not do the last integral. The last one you actually have to do. I'm going to set the actual last variable to 1 rather than using that complicated projective form. But it could do the last one numerically, and you could see that the answer is, if you do K4, the answer should be 6 Riemann zeta of 3. All right? So last time I tried this, Maple was not smart enough to do the last integration. Now, I gave this as an exercise to someone, and they did it in Mathematica and said, oh, Mathematica can actually do all of them. So, and that was about a year ago. So probably Maple can do all of them now, too, because, it's like an arms race. But you can try. If you're really bored and you got your computer there, you can say, all right, does Maple know how to do the last integration? The early ones, you can always actually do the first 5 integrations symbolically. It's just that Maple isn't smart enough to necessarily do the 5th one. All right? Okay, so I have planar dual invariant, completion invariant. Here's the next thing. So this is called the Schnetz twist, or informally the Oliver's twist, Oliver Schnetz's twist.
Because what happens? So I'm going to draw the completed graphs now. So here's a graph. It's got a four-vertex cut, or four-vertex join, however you want to think of it. And then I want to twist it. And what do I mean by that? I mean twist it like this. All right, anyone who's taking notes will realize I actually practiced that quite a bit. It's not that easy to draw it the first time you try. My grad student can never draw that. Anyway, so if you have, so these are completed, and so now decomplete. So you have this graph, and now take any decompletion of each of these, they have the same period. Oh, okay, and so I was saying, well, why are these things true? So why is completion followed by decompletion invariant of the period? It's because if you put the integral into position space, then you can send any one, you can make affine transformations. You can send any one vertex to infinity. And the vertex at infinity is the decompletion vertex, the one. Right, it's sort of not quite there because you put it at infinity. So that's why this is true. And then this, you can also prove this guy in position space through a more complicated change of variables, which I don't have on my sheet and I'm not going to be able to create off the top of my head. But it's not that bad. You look it up and it's just a little change of variables. All right, again, in position space. OK, so those are three graph operations that preserve the period. And now what else? There's also a product formula. And what does that look like? Well, in the completed land, what if I have a three-vertex cut? Well, then that's the same as the product of the periods of these two graphs. So decomplete this guy, period, is the product of decompletions of these guys. And now just as a special case, because it doesn't matter what vertex I decomplete at, so in particular I could decomplete always, say, at this guy. And so a special case, if I have already decompleted, if I decomplete there, I have a two-vertex cut with two external edges on each side. So that looks like this. And the period of that graph, and now we're decompleted, so legitimately that graph is the one I put into that over there. This is really the product. Let's say P of this graph is the product of P of this graph. There's two external there and two more there, times this guy. Two external there, and two external there. All right? So that's a product property. So we have four, pretty nice natural graph properties, planar dual, completion followed by decompletion, Schnetz twist, and this kind of a three-vertex joined product. And the first three, the period is invariant, and then this product property is a product of the periods. Okay. So now a natural question would be, what are some graph invariants that have these symmetries, that have these, that also satisfy these properties? Okay. And that should be section number 6. The interesting thing is, as far as I know, I don't know when I would say we actually proved this, but until 6 months ago, my understanding is there were no graph invariants that were known to have these symmetries. I mean, I guess the period itself is one. All right, it's not the sort of thing that makes a graph theorist really happy, but it is a graph invariant. Fine. As far as I know, there were none other than that. They were known. One that was conjectured, which is the C2 invariant, which probably Matilda did not mention, but it did show up in the title of some of the papers she cited. So it sort of was on the board. But that one was only conjectured to have these symmetries. I don't believe there are any that were known to have these symmetries. And so I'm going to tell you about one that has these symmetries. And this is joint work with my student Ian Crump, who can't draw the picture, and one of my colleagues who's a pure graph theorist, Matt DeVos. And this showed up on the archive. We finally finished writing it at the beginning of the week, so it has a nice fresh archive number, 1505-06987. They're in 5 digits now, as you probably all have noticed. But I hadn't actually noticed until I looked up that number to show it to you today. Okay, so what are we going to do? So what do I want? Given a graph, the first thing I want to do is form its signed incidence matrix. So for now, G can be any graph. So I need to give it an edge orientation, but the edge orientation is arbitrary. It's just to put the signs in the matrix correctly. Orient the edges of G arbitrarily. I didn't spell that right. Arbitrarily. And build the signed incidence matrix as follows. So we'll call it E. And what is E going to be? Well, the number of rows is going to be the number of vertices of the graph. And the number of columns is going to be the number of edges of the graph. And what am I going to put in? Well, I'll put in a 1 if that edge begins at that vertex. And I'll put in a -1 if that edge ends at that vertex. So that's not very formally written. So let's call it EIJ, where I don't want to lose my eraser. Where EIJ is equal to 1 if edge J begins at vertex I, -1 if the same thing with the end, and 0 otherwise. Should we make a small example of this? Would that be helpful, or is it clear enough what this object is? It's just it's exactly what you would usually do. Sometimes people take the transpose, but that's not a very interesting difference. Who would like an example? Nobody. Okay, fine. And if you did, you should be loud. You weren't loud enough. Okay, now what am I going to do? I'm going to take a graph. So make a definition. I want G to have the I want G to be like a 4-point graph in 5-4 in the sense
that the relationship between the edges and vertices matches up with what it should be. So that means that I would like the number of edges of the graph G to be twice, well, not quite twice the number of vertices, but twice the number of vertices of G minus 1. Did I say that correctly? Yes, I think I said that correctly. So for example, a 4.54 graph would be fine. Then what am I going to do? I'm going to build a matrix. Well, what do I do? Well, I should have to say more things. So let E twiddle be E with a row removed, any one row removed. If you know about the matrix tree theorem, this is an object you will be familiar with. Because if you think about that matrix, you can see that it is not full rank. And in particular, it's not full rank because the sum of the rows is 0, right? Because there's always a plus 1 and a minus 1 in every column. But that's as long as your original graph was connected, which I haven't been saying, but G should be connected, assumed to be connected throughout, then that's the only problem. And so it does have rank 1 less. And that's why we're getting rid of a row here, because we want a full rank matrix, but we want all the information. So this is the right guy. Then I want to take the permanent of the block matrix that's made of two copies of E. Of E twiddle. And then I want to take that modulo 3. And that is my object. You say, what the heck? That is a really weird object. Let me just say briefly, more generally, if the number of edges of the graph is k times the number of vertices of the graph minus 1, instead, so this isn't something that's relevant to our 4.54 story, but it certainly is true. You can instead look at the permanent of the block matrix that's made out of k minus 1 blocks of E twiddle. So k minus 1 times. And you can take that modulo k. Did I do that right? No, sorry. K times, and you can take this modulo k plus 1. Sorry, my shifting was wrong. Okay? Eraser, here it is. Here are my properties. I guess we know the properties, but I'll put this one up just in case. Now, your first thought is probably permanence. Usually, permanents are horrible. Oh, sorry, I should have asked. Does everyone know what the permanent is?
No?
The permanent is, imagine your favorite way of writing the definition of the determinant, and it'll have alternating signs. So just make them all plus. So do it in cofactor expansion, or if you like the sum over permutations, just remove that sign of the permutation bit. So whatever you like, whatever's your favorite way to think of the determinant, and take the signs out, right? So it's the one that your undergrad students, that they think they'd like better. But of course, it doesn't work. It's a stupid object from the point of view of linear algebra, because row reduction doesn't work, basically. And if you want a nice linear algebra object, you need to have row reduction work properly. Well, what goes wrong? The swap is okay, and here it's even easier. There's no sign. It doesn't even change the sign. It's fine. It does nothing. And scalar multiplication, again, that's not a problem. Think about cofactor expansion and just pull it out. No problem. The issue is the row operation where you add on a multiple of a row. But usually that doesn't work for the permanent. But here we have a very special case because we're going modulo something, and we have one fewer copies here. And what that actually does, if you think about adding on a multiple of a row, well,
using multilinearity, I can expand that out into two pieces. The piece that, you know, is what I want, plus the piece that's just where I added on the extra copy of the row. In that case, I'll have k copies of that row plus one more copy of that row for a total of k plus one copies of that row. And then just from the symmetries, if I'm going modulo k plus one, it's gone. So with these sort of matrices, as long as I do parallel row operations in every block so that it always stays in this block form, I can actually do row operations. So I have row reduction. So this is, in this weird case, a sensible linear algebra object. So should I write on the board what I just said in words, or is it okay? I guess because if you add a multiple of a row, the problem term goes away. Because it has k plus one copies of that row modulo k plus one. Okay, well, that's really nice. Because, well, first of all, that tells us that this is well-defined, almost well-defined. Because when I made a lot of choices here. I have a choice of orientation. I have a choice of the edge that I removed, the vertex that I removed, the row I removed. So let's start thinking about what those things do. Removing the row, because that removed row is just the sum of all the other rows, minus the sum of all the other rows. Now that I can do row reduction, that's fine. There could be a sign issue. I might end up multiplying by minus one. Likewise, if I chose a different arbitrary orientation, well, that would be swapping the sign of a column. So that, again, is only going to be swapping a sign. And so if you think about this, it's not quite well-defined. It's well-defined up to a sign. So here in this modulo 3 case, it actually says it's just a binary invariant. It's either 0 or non-zero modulo 3. In general, you'll have, you know, a k plus 1 over 2 different possible values for this invariant. So from this, so a consequence, it's well-defined up to sign. And furthermore, we can start thinking about these properties that we'd like to know that I'm, you know, I wrote this down. Surely I'm going to tell you that it satisfies these same graph properties. So we should start checking that. Wow, how did it end up being 4:30? Okay, great. So let's start with the planar dual, because the only thing we need for planar dual is row reduction, which we have now. To do row reduction, you need to know a fact about the planar dual that you might not know, but it's a standard fact. You can look it up. It's actually the matroid way of saying it. So if you don't see it in a standard graph theory book, you can look it up in a matroid book. But here it is. So if I have a graph G, so G is a graph, and I have this E tilde here, well, I could row reduce E tilde until it looks like an identity matrix and another block. Okay, that's always possible. Then the planar dual I can write down a matrix for it. If I haven't lost all my erasers, I can write down a matrix for it. Maybe I will remember what planar dual is. Okay, then the planar dual has matrix. Again, this is a has E tilde row equivalent to the following matrix, minus a transpose identity, the block matrix. I didn't put a line in my other block matrix, so I won't put a line in that block matrix. All right? So knowing that, it's pretty easy to see what's going on. So I take the permanent of IAIA. Okay, well, what's going to happen if I take this permanent? If I think of doing a cofactor expansion, well, I have to take either from this copy of I or from this copy of I for the first, for anything in these first columns. Okay, so that's going to kill exactly one of each of the A's. And then when I'm done, I will have an A left over, right?
So this is going to look like 2 to the whatever the size is. I haven't really said what it is. 2 to the n, let's say, permanent of A. OK, but modulo 3, that power of 2, modulo 3 and up to sine, that power of 2 is stupid. And so I just get permanent A. So this is plus or minus permanent A modulo 3. And on the other hand, if I take the permanent of minus A transpose I, well, the same thing happens, except now I've got a negative, extra negative sign, so it's negative 2 to the n permanent A, okay, which is still plus or minus permanent A modulo 3. All right, so the first one down, 3 to go. All right. Completion followed by decompletion. I won't show you all the painful details for all of them, don't worry. So for completion, let's think about this matrix here. So if I think about, again, taking a big, gigantic cofactor expansion, or I just think about the fact that I just lay some permutation matrix on here, well, when am I going to get a non-zero contribution? To get a non-zero contribution, I have to hit a 1 or a minus 1, you know, on all the places of my permutation. Well, and what does that mean? It means I picked every row, sorry, I picked every column once, so I picked every edge exactly once, and I picked every vertex twice, because there's two copies of every vertex, right? So I can represent that on a graph, on the graph, by, for each edge, I have to pick one of its two ends. That's like giving an orientation, but I've already got so many orientations in play. Let's just say it's like a tag. I'm going to tag one end of each edge. And I'm going to do it in such a way that every vertex is tagged 2 times, 2 of the 4 possible times. Okay. A contribution to the permanent. Is given by tagging one end of each vertex, of each edge, so that each vertex gets 2 tags. All right, that's false. Did anyone catch the problem? This is almost true. There's a caveat. Anyone see it? I have an E tilde here, right? E twiddle, not an E. So one vertex is special. It corresponds to the row that I removed. Well, that vertex doesn't get any tags. So each vertex gets 2 tags, except the what I'm going to call the special vertex, the one I removed to make E twiddle, special vertex, which gets none. Okay, fine. I don't actually want to erase that. I'll erase this.
okay, well, what do I want to do now? Now let's think about adding back in the decompletion vertex, right? So I've got some graph here. You know, here's a nice big graph. And most of these vertices have two tagged edges and two normal edges. And somewhere there's the special vertex that only has just no tagged edges at all. And if I complete, then somewhere I have my decompletion, my completion vertex. Well, it wasn't part of that story at all. So these edges, they're sort of new edges. They're not part of the story at all. If I want to bring them into the story, I'd like to tag them. Well, I better tag them at this end, because the other end, it's already dealt with. So I'm going to tag them at this end. Okay. So extend this tagging to the decompletion vertex. And now I have two special vertices, the decompletion vertex and the special vertex. One of them has all four edges tagged. The other one has zero edges tagged. So if I swap all the taggings, I've reversed the role of the special vertex and the decompletion vertex. And that's actually enough. The completion followed by decompletion follows. Because we already knew we don't care which special vertex it is. That's just a fact about row reduction. So now I can swap it for a decompletion vertex. And then using that, I can move the decompletion vertex anywhere. So completion invariance follows. All right, the twist is actually quite similar. But I only do the swap on one side. Basically, in that picture, imagine of those four vertices, make one the special vertex, one the decompletion vertex, and then swap just on one side the tags. And, well, there's something to check to make sure it does the right thing, but it does. Okay, that's fine. And then what's left? Well, what's left is the product. And product is actually even easier. So if I think about, I've got this guy here. Decomplete at one of them. There's three vertices that are distinguished here. Decomplete at one of them, of the three. Make one of the others special, which means it doesn't really appear, right? It's still sort of logically playing a role, but it's not actually there in the matrix. Make the other the special vertex. And that leaves just one, and just expand along that row. Okay, and because I know you guys can all do linear algebra and do not want to watch me do linear algebra on the board, I'm not going to, but it really does work. You expand along the last one. That's the only thing left that connected the two halves together. So you're going to get something for the one half and something for the other half. And if you check, you'll see that you do, in fact, get the product and that the two bits are, in fact, the correct bits that they should be. So that's our result. We have a invariant, that a graph invariant, that has the correct symmetries. So it's reasonable to suppose that it ought to be a period invariant in the sense that whenever two graphs have the same period, they ought to have the same one of these. And that's certainly true for all the identities we know of the period, but of course, you know, who knows, there may be lots of other special ones. And relatedly, this ought to tell you something about the period, and unfortunately that's the tricky part, is I actually have no idea what this means. So it's kind of cool, it has the right symmetries,
And if it has the right symmetries, it should mean something, right? But I don't know what it means. So this permanent has the right symmetries, but not obvious what it means. Are there any comments or questions on this before I briefly tell you about one last thing? You're like, too many graphs today. I like those trees better. Too many graphs. They're not nice. They have edges. All right, as a final section, I just wanted to briefly tell you, I sort of hinted that there was another thing that we think is that has these symmetries. We think is a graph invariant for these properties. And I just wanted to tell you what it is, because it's deeper, it's more arithmetic, it may well be more interesting to many of you guys. Although the actual work is, you know, it's not clear, and a lot of these things are just conjectural for it. So finally, let's talk about a deeper arithmetic graph invariant. And this is sometimes called C2, and it's due to Francis Brown and Oliver Schnitz. Okay, and so here, let's call this a proposition definition thing, because I'm going to write down something and claim that it makes sense. So let's let G be a graph with at least three vertices. Oh, you know, I credit it to them. It's their, they gave it this name, but I should also mention that this idea of thinking about this point count and the polynomials that may or may not be polynomials that underlie it, that's very much the sort of stuff that Matilda works on and has told us all about already today. So, yeah. So it's all connected together. It's all the same story, just from different viewpoints. Graph with at least three vertices, and let P be prime. And then I have C2 of G at the prime P, maybe I'll put it up there, is, well, and what is it? Well, I'm going to take my psi G, and I want to think of it as defining, you know, I want to think of a zero set. I want to think of the variety it defines, all right? And I want to count points on that over a finite field. So I didn't define any notation, but hopefully something like this will make everyone happy. Is that okay? People happy? Not really good notation, but is it clear enough? Count points on this guy over a finite field. Okay. This is the proposition part, is that that'll always be divisible by P squared. And then you want to take that result mod P. Okay? Now, where am I going to write next? I guess I don't need this anymore. So where did this come from? This came from the fact that if these guys were all mixtate, like we were hearing about earlier, then all these point counts would be a polynomial in the prime. And this C2, would really be the coefficient of the quadratic term. Now, if they're not mixtate, then you could still calculate these for all p. It just won't be a constant. It'll be something that changes. And so you have some sequence. Ooh, sequences. I like sequences. And you can say, well, what information can it contain? And the answer is, it seems to contain a lot of information about the period. It seems to be, like this guy, it seems to have all the right symmetries. And much better than this guy, it's not just a binary invariant. I mean, for p equals 2, it is. But if I think of this as a sequence indexed by the primes, that's a lot more information than this stupid little permanent. So this ought to be a really nice invariant. And at least if you want to calculate it explicitly for some small primes, you can do that pretty easily computationally. So it's something you can play with pretty explicitly. So that's nice. And it's conjectured to have all the right symmetries. same graph properties. But sadly, very few of these are proved. So what is known? If you assume completion invariance, then the product property is proven. Then product. Planar dual is known up to some technical conditions. This is due to Dmitry Doran. And that's about it. So here we are in a situation. We would like to understand these periods. The periods themselves, at least from my point of view, are really very hard. And then you would say, oh, C2, that's better. But actually, it's really hard too. Almost all the things we want it to do are still mostly conjectural. And so, well, playing around, I didn't tell you where that permanent comes from, but it actually comes from some flow calculations from pure graph theory. Well, okay, now we have an invariant that does the right thing, but it's not clear what it means. And it's only binary anyway. So the take-home message here, I think, at least my view of the take-home message, is there really is a lot of interest in graph theory. You know, I think sometimes from the geometric perspective or the physics perspective, you think that the details of the graph are just some sort of things that aren't interesting, that don't have any deep significance. But I think that's not true. I think that graph theory really is saying quite a lot. But it's not easy business, and I don't have any magic answers. It's still really hard to extract the information that you're looking for, whichever perspective you like to take. And really, I think the best perspective is when we all use our different viewpoints and put things together, and then awesome things happen. And I'm going to stop there. Thank you very much.
So a lot of this discussion involved graphs of four-point vertices. Have you put any thought into graphs of three-point vertices?
Okay, so there's two ways you could think about that. You could say, okay, let's keep it scalar because you know, that then you're still just a polynomial, and it's sort of nice from an algebra geometric perspective. But then, of course, you're in six dimensions, and so your polynomial is cubed. And actually, there a certain amount of it still does work. I know that Eric Panzer has done some calculations for the phi cubed stuff, and sort of qualitatively what's going on is very different, which you would expect as a physicist. But you can use many of the same tools, and I mean, I haven't spent my time thinking about it, but I think there's some cool stuff there. The other thing you could say is, okay, well, I would like to do three valent vertices, but I want to stay in four dimensions, so I need to use more complicated Feynman rules. And again, the shape of the denominator is still going to be controlled by the same polynomial. So, and that's the zeros of that polynomial are they're important, right? They're telling you where you're getting singularities in your integral. So I would say morally, a lot of this story should still work, but the details are gigantic there, right? I mean, those details are gigantic. Again, the best person to talk to, I think, is Eric Panzer. So he's probably the one from this community who's been trying to really do calculations that are at least only a step or two away from hardcore physics calculations, and he's had a fair bit of success. So I think these tools are actually useful, but you can't just go download them and sort of poof, they work. There's still, you know, you need the both sides need to do some legwork to put it together. Is that helpful? Oh, that's a good question. That is not known to me. It's possible that it might be known to some people, but it's not known to me.
Why is it C2? Are there generalizations of these?
The idea is, it was back to this thing that if everything was mixtape, then I guess there's another talk that uses the board or something. I don't think I touched anything. If it was mixtape, then the counting, the point count function as a function of P would be a polynomial in P. And then this C2 would be the quadratic coefficient of that polynomial. And it turns out for these graphs, as long as your graph is sufficiently big that it's non-trivial, that there is the constant term and the linear term are both zero. So C2 is the first thing that really shows up. Now, of course, that was all a lie because they're not in general mixtape, but it is still true that what would be the constant term and would be the linear term are both zero, and so this is still a well-defined object. It's just, it's no longer just a constant coefficient. It depends on P. And so that's why I was thinking of it as a sequence indexed by primes. Thank you.